Blog Talk Radio.
Coming up next on Movie Geeks United, actor Ron Perlman and director Simon Hunter discuss their new film Mutant Chronicles, and producer Andrew Trapani talks about his new smash hit, The Haunting in Connecticut. Coming up next. Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everybody. My name is Jamie. I thank everyone out there for joining us tonight. First up tonight, we'll be discussing a new film called Mutant Chronicles. It's a futuristic adventure that opens in theaters on April 24th and is currently available on all video on demand systems. This futuristic adventure stars an impressive cast, including John Malkovich, Thomas Jane, and Ron Perlman, and we'll be discussing the film with Mr. Perlman in just a moment. But first up, a conversation with the director of the film, Mr. Simon Hunter.
What was the first movie-going experience that you remember leaving an impression on you that where you said, you know what, I want to do something with movies?
I remember, that's a good question, I remember seeing Chitty Chitty Bang Bang when I was 4 or 5. I remember it very well. I remember the scene where the car goes over the cliff when they're driving along chasing the vile Huns across the field, and the little car scoots over the cliff and falls and falls and falls, and then the wings come out. I remember that very well. That was like my first movie experience, I remember. It was a real impression. I came out of that and make movies, I think that was like 4 or 5 years old.
And so, was it always you wanted to be the director, or did you just want to do something you didn't know what?
No, I always, I think I had to do them and be in charge. Really, I made movies. I started making movies when I was like 7 or 8. I had a little Super 8 camera as a present when I was 7 years old, so kind of ran around with my family making movies, and then right. Eventually, you know, I went to school when I was 8 or 9 and started making films with my friends, and I kind of, it was always a copy of the movie of the day. We made Woodraker, which was like a version of Moonraker, like, but in the woods, and stuff like that. We were always doing, Space 1999 was on telly in those days, and I remember doing kind of little versions of that with little eagles that we bought, and stuff like that. It was. Yeah.
Well, with any luck, your version was probably better than Moonraker.
Really, I it's funny when you love something as a kid. I really loved that movie as a kid, and I don't know if you ever get any perspective again when you look back at something.
Right.
As you look back, but actually, often you do look back and you think, God, did I really like that? It looks terrible. A bit long, Moonraker, possibly.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, if I understand correctly, your dad was a headmaster at a prep school.
That's true.
So, what was that like being, you know, your dad's a headmaster, so he's very authoritative with education, and you supposedly are, you know, cutting class to make movies.
Well, that is true. I didn't expect that question, and that is a good question. And it was very I got into trouble a lot from him. I think he probably didn't want me to go into filmmaking because it was just like it's such a, you know, such a lottery, and it's such a hard career that it's just there's so many people want to do it, and I don't think he ever really wanted me, so he was always trying to warn me off. Me, the camera, he was kind of half in, he loved photography himself, so he was kept buying me these cameras even though he didn't want me to do it. And I remember when I was 18, I went to Africa to make a documentary in Zaire about a riverboat journey going up and down the Zaire River. And then I spent like 2 months there doing this documentary. And I came back and I showed it to him. And I realized at that point he thought I possibly could make it because it was such a technical standard. So I kind of got his blessing at the very end. But it was a fairly... it was a difficult childhood. I don't think he wanted me to be doing what I was doing, but
right.
Yeah, no, he was very thorough. I think he'd prefer me to be a lawyer somewhere in Edinburgh in Scotland or something like that. I'm not sure I was smart enough.
Well, and being, you know, being in living in Scotland and so forth, was it, you know, American movies that influenced you, or
yeah, of course. I think it is mostly with kids. Yeah, it was mostly American movies. I mean, maybe with international directors, but
right. But
effectively more mainstream. Absolutely, yeah. No, the stuff I was watching was I remember watching Goldfinger a million times and movies like that, and it was all the mainstream stuff. And then you had the golden era in the 70s, didn't you? You had Star Wars,
right.
Jaws, and it was a real time for movies. It's when we left, I suppose, the more intelligent. I don't know if that's fair, not more intelligent, but you know what I'm saying. You're more interesting, more intellectually complex movies were left for a bit more of the tentpole summer event movies came in. So it was a real crossover time in Hollywood, and
right.
It was it was a time before it was kind of one or the other. But now it's with the cost of technology is so much cheaper that and more ways of getting the product to the people now that effectively you can have a much broader. You can make almost any movie you want there, really.
And what was it like when, I guess you were a teenager when, the Bill Forsyth movies were coming out and they were crossing over, here on our shores, and then, other, Scottish tinged movies were starting to, break out to that.
Yeah, I mean, most of the movies before that were in Scotland that were effectively, even Gregory's Girl, thinking about that, I suppose, they're still fairly parochial stories, but when that sort of hit and came out, really, and Local Hero and stuff, they were, they started to tell a bit more of an international tale that could appeal to people all around the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. I mean, I always liked Scottish cinema, and I've always wanted to do a movie in Scotland. I haven't yet, but I keep asking everybody I see if you've got, have you got a thriller set in Scotland, like a kind of Eye of the Needle or something like that. That's what I'd like to go and do.
Right.
But I haven't found that script yet. I keep hunting for it, but I haven't found it yet.
You kind of figure, with all the globetrotting that the Bond films do, they've yet to, I don't think they've gone to Scotland in a long, long time.
They haven't really ever gone to Scotland. There's a couple of movies where they've kind of one of the last Pierce Brosnan ones, the penultimate one, I forgot what it was called. They went to Scotland there, and effectively that was like M's headquarters there and a castle there. But it was like a couple of shots. There was nothing really. No, we've seen no great chase around the mountains or a chase through Edinburgh or something. It's really odd that really. It's a great city. Some great cities up there, and they could, make something very exciting. Or maybe they will in the future.
Well, and so in film school, what did you went to film school? You had a hard time with regular school, but you did get into film school. And so what did those years teach you? What did you get from film school?
It taught me. I suppose the best thing about film school is you meet other filmmakers who are like-minded or not, as the case may be, and it slightly forms you where you want to go. I mean, I kind of entered film school thinking I might want to do documentaries because I'd made a few just before. I kind of went through a teenager phase of making documentaries and things like that, and I was quite interested in that because, it seemed to me fairly easy to go and do because, to make a good one is very hard, but actually just to technically make them, it was much easier than a drama. But actually at film school I decided I was going to try and do drama and have a go at making movies that were mainstream and entertaining and so on and so forth. So I put my head down and I made my first film there called Click, which was like somebody has their hand stuck down a waste disposal unit in during a thunderstorm until the power comes on. So I developed a very mainstream kind of taste there. I mean, back a bit more back to being a kid again, really. I suppose I just
right.
my back to being back my roots really, and came out of my teenager slightly pretentious years of making. Worthy stuff that I was a bit more back to my big graduation film was called Tea and Bullets. It was about two pensioners who were crossing England to find King Arthur, and it was a shameless rip-off of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. At the time, we did everything. We did like a balloon chase. We did a car chase. We had scenes in the sea. It was just, we were out of our minds, I think. But I learned a lot.
And so I guess now you got Mutant Chronicles. How did this rather, you know, massive project come to you? And I guess explain that an outline of Mutant Projects for our listeners.
Mutant Chronicles tells the tale of a group of soldiers set in the future in a kind of alternate universe where coal powers everything and steam powers everything, where a group of soldiers head into the center of the Earth to destroy a machine that's making mutants. Basically, it makes mutants by taking dead bodies of soldiers killed in the Earth during all the battles that happen on the Earth. It takes them into the machine, the mutant machine, and transforms them into mutants. And a sort of crack group of soldiers have to head down into the center of the Earth and blow this machine up. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the tale. And it came about as it was originally going to be a big kind of tentpole kind of movie thing, and no one ever got going with it. A few directors came and went, and they weren't going to do it. And then I came on board. It was going to be still the same thing. It was going to be a big movie. And eventually we couldn't get the money together for whatever reason. No one wanted to invest in it. Mm-hmm. And a few years went by, and I remember in the year 2005, I contacted Ed Pressman, who's the producer, and I said, listen, why don't we try and do this like as an independent movie, like, you know, smaller scale, but there's a few techniques, I think, because of what I've been doing in commercials, I think we can use to really help us and make something that's very unique and interesting. And, you know, what do you think? And Ed got me a few $1,000s together, and we went and made a little mood film, which kind of showed the style and mood and feel of the big movie. And we made that like over 4 or 5 months, basically in kind of in my garage kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then once we did that, I came over to Hollywood and effectively screened it like around every studio, and loads of people saw it and people got excited, and eventually we ended up getting some money from some various sources, some kind of pre-sales and tax money and things, and we put that together and we went out and made this kind of colossal independent movie, really, where it was, you know, we shot for sort of 8 weeks, and then like 30 of us sort of were locked in a room for like 2 years making this world, really. And we were using every kind of lower budget film technique that we could imagine. You know, we were all doing traditional matte paintings. We were shooting little miniatures. We were, you know, doing all sorts of camera tricks that to create this sort of handcrafted kind of movie, really.
Yeah.
We spent a long time doing it. And we went for a very impressionistic kind of stylized world that wasn't, you know, your big summer movie. It wasn't big cutting edge stuff. It wasn't, you know, creatures,
right,
and things that I knew we couldn't do. So we went for something that was very different. It was much more a kind of metropolis-y kind of film. Mm-hmm. It wasn't dissimilar to what the Germans did in the 30s when, you know, they were having trouble competing with Hollywood at the time. So they effectively went for a very impressionistic approach when they did sort of German expressionist film. And effectively, I mean, without being pretentious, that's kind of what we were trying to do, really.
Mm-hmm.
We hoped that style would see us through.
Mm. And the cast you assembled, you know, these are some heavy hitters who've done a good job of straddling, you know, mainstream films and independent lower budget films, guys like Ron Perlman and Thomas Jane and so what's it like?
It's amazing. And Ron and Thomas, they've both been, what's interesting is they'll do what they like, those guys. They don't have which is really cool about them. They don't have this kind of master plan of, I should be doing these kind of films or that. They'll just like, oh, this would be cool to do, and they'll go and do it. And then suddenly, you know, 1 minute Thomas is in doing Mutant Chronicles, and then the next minute he's doing The Mist, you know, and he's, you know, he's doing different kind of stuff all the time, and it's Ron Perlman to do what he wants, and Ron is exactly the same. Yeah, they go from, oh, this is a very low budget film, but it's kind of about this. Oh, that would be cool. We'll go and do this, and then suddenly they're doing a, you know, whatever, Hellboy 2, and, you know, and they jump around from thing to thing, and they don't, you know, it's not, they don't have this kind of awfully career set thing that so many actors have. They just, they do what they like, and they put everything into it, and they're really professional, and they're top guys. They really are. They were one of the best things about this project. I mean, everyone always says that, but I really mean it. I mean, they were so loyal to the production, and they, you know, they'd be there every day with good ideas, and you know, turn up on time, and it would just make everything is led from the top. And if your actors are really cool and into it and enthusiastic, then the whole shoot goes well, and it was a kind of blessing that they were.
Well, and then I got to ask about kind of the some would say the grand poobah in your cast would be, I guess, Malkovich, John Malkovich.
Yes. Yeah, so Malkovich, he's in it for briefly in the film. We needed somebody of gravitas to play the role of Constantine,
right?
Which is kind of the guy who controls the. He's kind of like the UN Secretary General of the future, really. The guy who's going to, you know, is controlling all these warring corporations who don't like each other,
right.
And he kind of lends the Ron Perlman his. His ship to take the soldiers on the mission into the center of the earth. So he kind of sacrifices himself to do that. So we needed somebody who could really, you know, pull that off. So that's that's why he's there.
Well, and I'll ask. I guess probably someone a lot of people don't ask, but tell me about Ed Pressman, because Ed Pressman is probably one of the unsung great producers in Hollywood. If anyone was to ever
really,
read his credits, they'd be shocked at how many quality films that Pressman has his hands in.
It's amazing. People should look up his CV online, and it's just an amazing catalogue of. And there's not much theme, actually, when you look through his films. When you look at the type of films, I think he likes working with directors he finds interesting and goes with them, and he's a real throwback. When you see Ed, he's a real, how I imagined so many movie producers were in the kind of 20s and 30s. He really gets behind a project. He's very loyal to the director and backs them 100%. He's tenacious in finding the money. And you think of, you know, maybe forgetting his more you know, successful movies, but even movies where they're very strange or unusual subject matter, and he still manages to go and get some money to go and make those movies. And that takes persuasion and talent to do that, because it's
right.
When you're convincing people to do, you know, premises that aren't your mainstream, you know, normal premises, he can go and do that, and he's done that for years, and he keeps going. And to be an independent producer in today's world is pretty impressive. I mean, he's
right.
Yeah, you know, he's broken so many careers as well. Because he's got, I think probably Ed's greatest talent, he's got two things. He's tenacious. He'll always never take no for an answer. He will battle away at something till he gets an answer that he wants. So he'll always do that. He never gives up. And two, I think he's got innate good judgment on, I don't mean this for me, I just mean for everybody else, you know, in terms of judging people, giving them breaks. Most
right.
people he's given breaks to have gone on to do, you know, really interesting things. And those are, I think, Ed's two, you know, very unique qualities, and they've seen him through well. And I'm sure he's got a few movies left.
Well, and before I let you go, I'll ask what's in the pipeline for you next?
Next movie is a movie I hope to do, which is about somebody who comes back from the war. This is like Afghanistan, Iraq war. And they're convinced, they've got a huge scar down their whole body, and they're absolutely convinced a bomb has been sewn inside them. And they become absolutely paranoid. They start to get a rash, which is what you get from Semtex, being close to your skin. And they, as the film goes on, they're more and more convinced this is what's happened. And it plays out from there. It's a very good script. It's very not at all like Mutant. In fact, there's nothing. Even if you saw the movie, you would wonder, you know, what the connection with the mutant people who brought you Mutant Chronicles. Nothing. It's a kind of East Coast American thriller. It's intense and very gripping and fantastic screenplay. It's just what I want to do, really. It's you know, live action as well, which would be nice. I could take a break from visual effects, I think, just for a little bit.
And so, are you looking at casting right now, or getting the script in the shape?
We are looking at casting right now. I can't say anything at the moment, but I hope soon.
Okay, that's Simon Hunter, the director of Mutant Chronicles. Simon is a first-time feature film director with Mutant Chronicles, and a good friend to first-time directors is actually one of his co-stars of the film, who is Ron Perlman. And one of the first-time directors that Ron Perlman shepherded early on in his career was none other than Guillermo del Toro, and that paid off in dividends with Hellboy, the Hellboy series, which is really reinvigorated Mr. Perlman's cult status, something that started way back in the day with the Beauty and the Beast television series. And he really is a phenomenon of an actor. He's one of those guys that we love to follow on screen, and he works quite a lot. He has quite a lot of credits to his name, and he's very distinctive in every single one of those projects. Here we talk about the film Mutant Chronicles, what he likes about the character, and a few other things about the craft of acting. My understanding of the project, it's kind of a big-budget project made on a smaller budgeted scale. They used all the tools in their arsenal to make it look very impressive. And I was wondering, for you as an actor, you've done so much work, big budget, smaller budget. Does that dictate any change in performance? Does it dictate different demands in your performance?
No, I mean, you always come to the work with the same set of parameters, the same hopefully levels of engagement. You know, the circumstances change, but there are certain things that must never change. You know, which is the approach to the work. I actually appreciate the underdog in these scenarios.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more than I appreciate the being in a situation where the machine is so overwhelmingly large and unwieldy.
Yeah.
And in this case, you know, watching Simon make what essentially is an amazingly high concept tentpole-like film with the resources he had, and I'm not at liberty to mention how much this movie was made for, but trust me when I tell you, it's a fraction of what, you know, would have been spent for the same kind of movie, you know, under different circumstances.
Yeah.
And yet the movie, I've seen it now twice. I'm quite proud of it. Never once does it look like it's breathing heavy. Never once does it look like it's been compromised or fudged or made to look cheesy because they just, you know, on any given day got undermined by, you know, their lack of resources. And I have to give all the credit in the world for the high quality of what ultimately appears on the screen.
Yeah.
To Simon Hunter. You know, he took him a year and a half to finish the film because he had nothing to work with, and he had to do everything in such a painstakingly low-tech way. But he did it, and he did it in such a way that the film is worth everyone's attention.
Yeah.
And he's a filmmaker of rare and unique ability.
I would certainly agree, and I think it's a very impressive looking movie, and so when I mentioned a smaller budget, that wasn't I wasn't speaking about the quality of the film, because obviously it's a high quality film. But in terms of the working environment, when he spoke of it, he said that all of you were such a tight kind of unit, and you're all in there working to put this thing together the way it deserved to be. Did you feel that on this set, that there was a level of kind of intimacy, like everyone was in it for a common purpose?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I every one of us to a man believed very much in the ethereal, high quality, intelligent way that this material was being depicted, and appreciated the fact that we might, you know, be involved in something special. So the level of enthusiasm was high.
Yeah.
The company of actors that were assembled were phenomenal.
They're amazing. Yeah.
And you know, no egos. You know, there was nobody there was, you know, a part of this production that was making retirement money. Certainly, I mean, you know, we were all doing this because we believed in the material, and nobody was getting rich, which makes for the playing field to be rather even. And it's an environment I like working in because there's no cynicism. You know,
Yeah. The
order of the day is enthusiasm and devotion and the desire to help a young filmmaker achieve his vision rather than some other set of, you know, agendas or circumstances.
Oh, yeah.
So
what did you respond to in this? I'm so sorry if I broke your train of thought.
No, I was done. Well, I first and foremost responded to how intelligently the script was written. You know, I loved, you know, the way he solved the problem of what a world 400 and some years into the future would look like, that there are no longer any nations, but that now that the world has been divvied up into four overwhelmingly powerful corporations, corporations being soulless and heartless and, you know, not having to answer to any of the tenets of the human condition.
Right.
So that immediately got my attention. And the dialogue was smart and crisp, and the characters were compelling and sympathetic and real. And then, of course, the character that they asked me to look at, Brother Samuel, was somebody who I truly aspired spending time with. And because he's such a humanist in a world that has been so dehumanized, and he's got, you know, just this amazing heart and single-minded devotion toward preserving what is good in mankind, and to the point where he's willing to, you know, put his own life on the line.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something quite important about, you know, being given the opportunity to play a guy like that.
Yeah. And when you speak about the character like you just did, tell me about your criteria with choosing roles, because you've got a lot of credits under your belt. And so when you read a script, do you look for that particular character? Do you look for the company that you're going to be involved in, the script itself? What's your criteria for choosing roles?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all of those things. First and foremost, I got to feel like I can play the guy. You know, if I feel like I don't have a strong handle on what the writer is looking for, then, you know, I stay away. But so that's first and foremost. Second of all, is it something that I've never done before, and how engaged do I think I can be by trying to figure out who the guy is? And that's what it is. It's an exercise in trying to figure out who the guy is. And, you know, he's got to be interesting enough and idiosyncratic enough and unique enough to want to spend 3, 4, 5, 6 months with. And then, of course, it's all the other things. It's like, do these people have a shot of making this film commensurate with what the potential of it is on the page? Do they have the resources? Do they have the other cast members? Is this director equipped for... Because if you know you're going to go into something that has a big chance of failing, you know, you try to avoid those situations. So that's it. That's the whole criteria for me. Having said that, I like working with first-time directors a lot because when I did Guillermo del Toro's film Kronos, he had never directed anything before, and you know, there I was getting a chance to participate in the emergence of what is turning out to be one of the most important voices in cinema that we have.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And I love the idea of maybe making Lightning Strike again and, you know, being involved with somebody else who's emerging and getting a shot at being a new important voice. So I'm a sucker for low budget. I'm a sucker for first timers.
Yeah, I think that's
great. And I'll always make little adjustments, you know, to try to accommodate those requests when they come in.
And you also strike me as an actor who is in love with the process. You like to work, and I'm wondering if that speaks to your stage experience. If you could speak a little about what you feel as an actor when you walk on a film set, what your extensive stage experience does for you.
Well, I'm so far from my early days on stage. What I learned by the old days in theater, which were basically in the 60s and 70s,
mm-hmm.
And a little bit in the 80s, I guess, in the early 80s, was, you know, just what a professional actor has to do to be ready on the day to do what he's been asked to do. So there was a work ethic that was strongly articulated. And then there was the relationship with the material, you know, that, you know, you have an obligation to do what you think the writer intended, and to find ways to shine a light on it, do your part. Your little part is a fraction of what ends up being the whole, but, you know, you're obligated first and foremost to do the material. Along the way, you know, you just pick up little tidbits of, you know, building character and the technical aspects of it. Just that all just comes with the doing of it over and over and over again to varying degrees of success and failure. And there's a lot of failure. There's a lot of trial and error. There are a lot of things that I did that were tremendously horrible that I learned more from than things that I did that were okay. So
You
have to embrace the possibility of falling on your face, understand that, you know, there isn't much to be learned from that as long as you don't crash and burn, than as there is anything else you could be occupying your time with.
Absolutely. Let me ask you one more question before I let you go, because I know you're pressed for time, and I appreciate this very much. It's a great honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you.
Another tremendous actor that you get to work with, and this has just a fantastic cast, as you mentioned, is Malkovich. Now, he's fascinating to me. tell me your insights into how he works.
Well, he really, really, really has a completely unique way of working. Unfortunately, he was only on this movie for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, in the unfortunateness of it, all of the scenes he had were with me. So on those 2 days, you know, if I was able to get any kind of window, I was the only one in the cast that did. But I would never be able to put my finger on what John's process is. He's a very bright guy. I think from the neck up, he's like in a class by himself, and he utilizes that great intellect in his, you know, the imaginative process that goes into who a character is and how he wants to portray that character.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you ask John to do a job, it's not going to get done like anybody else is going to do it, that's for sure, because he doesn't think like anybody else. He thinks very much about idiosyncrasies. You know, once he absorbs who he thinks the character is, then he thinks about behavior and idiosyncrasy. And it's a very brave way of working. Because he likes to put himself on the thinnest branch of the tree and then just hope he doesn't, you know, fall off. And I admire guys who have those, you know, balls big enough to work like that.
Yeah, like
so
a
I really,
tightrope, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, I really I enjoyed my 2 days with John.
Well, Ron, thank you so much, my friend. I love what you do, and I appreciate your time very much today.
My pleasure, my friend. It was nice chatting with you.
All righty, that's Ron Perlman. Unfortunately, we only had 15 minutes with Mr. Perlman, but he was very generous with us, and and spoke in great depth about his new film, Mutant Chronicles. That film opens in theaters April 24th, and it is currently available on all video on-demand services, so look it up. It's quite a vision. Okay, next up, the new film, The Haunting in Connecticut, opened very impressively this past weekend. I believe our interview subject here says that it's the highest-grossing horror film outside of the Saw series for Lionsgate. It's a great film, and it stars Virginia Madsen and a host of other great character actors. It's a supernatural thriller, and today we'll be speaking to the producer of that film, Andrew Trapani. And this is a big film for him, the first of what is certain to be a very impressive and colorful career. So let's hear from Andrew.
Congratulations. You had a really nice opening weekend.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, what does this feel like for a producer leading up to that opening? And then obviously you had a pretty nice opening, and I would imagine you're kind of exhaling right now and you know, feeling very relieved. What is that whole process like?
Well, I think there's definitely a certain amount of relief and, a large degree of elation. It's a very, very large opening, just north of $23 million for a film in this genre. And our studio, Lionsgate Film, has actually really only had one horror film open at larger numbers, and those were the sequels to the wildly successful Saw franchise. So I'm excited, relieved, but I think most pleased that we seem to be getting a really, really strong audience response and great word of mouth on the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And this seems like, where does this film fall for you in if you group it in the horror genre, so to speak? Because this seems very much more more of a psychological project in a way. It doesn't rely as much on what a lot of movies of this genre rely on nowadays.
Well, I think we sort of, toe the line. We think effectively between the psychological and the supernatural.
Right.
And without giving too much of the plot of the film away, there's definitely an aspect that treads solely on the psychological, where you wonder if what is happening in this house is really just a byproduct of this rather severe cancer treatment that the main character is undergoing.
Right. Right. So tell me a little bit about you and your journey into making films. Were you immediately taken by films as a kid, and what kinds of films did you enjoy then?
I grew up watching movies, to be sure. Three older brothers, the youngest of four boys, so I think the parental reins were loosened a little bit on what I was able to, get my eyes on.
Right.
And believe it or not, I was watching a lot of Mel Brooks comedies, along with my Scooby-Doo and Woody Woodpecker. somewhere probably around, 10, 11, 12 years old, I really sort of fell into this pretty strong fascination with horror movies. I think in large part because I was afraid of them.
Right.
There was a time when I would, just shudder at the sight of any sort of skeleton or corpse. The cheesiest movie of the week with a skeleton on it would, give me nightmares for 2 weeks. So I part to sort of, conquer that fear, I kind of fell into really appreciating quality horror films, and I watched great ones and a lot of really bad ones as well.
Yeah.
So my entertainment career began actually in the video game business, which was just a wonderful intersection of circumstance where I took a summer job testing video games. And when it was time to go back to college, they offered me a full-time job, and that was a pretty easy decision to make.
Yeah.
So I ended up staying at this company for a year and producing video games, and later on that became a natural progression to producing movies.
And so what kind of, when you set out to produce films, what kind of voice did you want to establish for yourself? What kind of movies did you want to be involved in?
I think initially when you first start out as a producer, you're so preoccupied with just getting something done. You want to sell a movie. It seems like such a huge task to sell a movie to a studio or a production company, and even a larger task to actually get one produced. So I think that the things that attracted me initially were things that I thought were commercial. be it a video game title, a comic book, a true story. So a lot of the things that I sold initially were in that vein. And as I've progressed now in my career, I'm finding that biopics are becoming of large interest. Some bigger action films are also really attractive to me. But I think what it comes down to is really just interesting characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, when I'm watching movies, you know, that's pretty much where the rubber meets the road, is having some emotional investment in, you know, what I'm going to be watching for the next, you know, 90 minutes or 2 hours.
Yeah. And what about Haunting in Connecticut spoke to you when you were first approached with it?
It's a really kind of interesting story, because at that time, and this dates back to almost 2003, we were working on setting up the remake of the Amityville Horror. And a writer that we were working with by the name of Dan Ferens, who had written one of the Halloween sequels.
Yeah, we've spoken with him, yeah.
Sure. Dan's a great guy, was a fellow producer on Haunting in Connecticut. You know, Dan brought this documentary into my office one day, and I'll never forget it. He handed me the disc, and it was the Discovery Channel documentary called A Haunting in Connecticut. And his quote was, "This is scarier than Amityville." And that was kind of the beginning of the journey. I watched it that night and was just immediately taken with, you know, obviously the supernatural tropes that were there in this story, this true story, but the fact that there was so much human drama going on, you know, juxtaposed with this supernatural tale. So for me, it was probably one of the most unique stories in this genre that I'd ever been exposed to, and I just was really confident that we could make a great movie and that there would be, you know, a mass market for it.
Yeah. And in terms of when you set out to build this crew and this cast that'll bring this to life, what was the process to find Peter, your director? You know, I would think that would be the key ingredient, someone whose vision matches up with yours.
That's a fact. But before we could really get to the director, we felt that we needed a blueprint. We needed a script. At the time when we first started shopping this project, you know, Amityville had just been released in 2005. So many people were questioning whether or not it was too close to that. So we ended up selling the movie on pitch to Gold Circle Films with two very talented writers, Tim Metcalf and Adam Simon.
Right.
And we basically, you know, wrangled this script in development for about a year and a half until we felt it was right. And fortunately, Lionsgate agreed, and they came on board to partner. And at that time, that's when we set out on our director search, when we felt like we really had the right script. And as far as Peter is concerned, anyone just has to take one look at his claymation short, Ward 13. And if you don't want to work with this guy based on that, you're probably in the wrong line of work. And both everyone at Lionsgate and Gold Circle and the writers and myself, we were all excited to work with Peter on this.
Yeah. Are you I would imagine so. Are you a very hands-on producer? Are you present on the set every day?
I am indeed. You know, this project was a real journey, and I was there for, you know, every iterative draft of screenplay development, and I was there for every day of production and, you know, all the iterative cuts in post-production through our, you know, test screening process and up until the film's release. So I think for me that's the most rewarding aspect is staying with the project all the way through. Obviously,
yeah.
I'm working on a million other things simultaneously, but it's particularly gratifying to have the film be well-received, you know, having spent so much time beginning, middle, and end, you know, to see it to the screen.
Mm-hmm. And is there something special about the environment on a set like this particular genre film? Is there something a bit more visceral about it?
I mean, there's a certain measure of intensity, I think, just as a byproduct of the subject matter.
Right.
I'm not sure if you've had a chance to see the film, but, you know, it's PG.
I did. I liked it very much, yeah.
Oh, great. Great. Excellent. You know, it's PG-13, which means it's more about what we don't show, and it's more about building suspense.
Right.
So while there are definitely some, you know, some gruesome moments, we're not doing a lot of stuff on set that's really visually going to make you want to run away shrieking in terror. But, yes, there's a certain measure of intensity and a certain sort of, environment that has to be cultivated if you want this stuff to be believable. You know, there's a certain measure of intensity in the actors' performances where you have to believe these people are scared for their lives. So I guess the irony is that we had one of the most collaborative, productive, hardworking sets And everyone really came at this from a standpoint of feeling like they were making something great. So, yes, everyone's intense, but it was also a very jovial set at the same time. Yeah, we were incredibly lucky to land the cast, you know, from top to bottom. And obviously it sort of all begins with Ms. Virginia Madsen, our Oscar nominee. And, you know, we had a very, very short list of actors for this role, and she was basically at the top of it. So when we cast Virginia, we felt like we were kind of sending a message that, you know, this film was different than others, and, you know, it could attract, this script could attract an actor of this caliber. So from there, we just continued to get lucky having Virginia on board.
Yeah, terrific cast you've gotten this. Obviously, you were with the project from the get-go. You're with it through conception, and now it's been born. Does when you finally watch it with an audience, does anything about it surprise you?
It's an interesting question. I think the one thing that surprised me, both as a viewer myself when I first saw it with an audience at our first test screening, and also noting the audience response, was just really how emotionally invested these people were in this story, to the degree that some people were actually shedding tears in the climax. And, you know, I've seen it so many times that I'm, you know, nothing's going to scare me or surprise me, but I still find that if I'm watching it with an audience, I still get emotionally involved, and I can still feel that little twinge of emotion, you know, for the characters in the film. So I think that's something that when we first set out to write this, that we thought could be possible. We thought we could get the scares and get the emotional involvement, but I never thought we'd have people in tears. So that was probably the biggest surprise.
Yeah. Have you watched it with an audience this opening weekend, this past weekend?
You know, I have. on about a week ago, opening night, we were at a very large theater in Los Angeles, and Peter Cornwell, the director, and myself, and our executive from Lionsgate, we sort of bounced back and forth between two showings that were an hour apart, and they were both completely sold out. And of course, we're not watching the screen. We're kind of tucked in the corner watching the audience. And it's just a real thrill. It's really, really gratifying to see people going on the ride and enjoying it and jumping when you'd hope they would jump and screaming when you'd hope they would scream. And like I said, at the end, getting the heartstrings tugged. So it's a lot of fun to watch it with an audience.
Yeah, I bet it is. What's upcoming for you? Do you have any projects in the fire?
Quite a few, actually. I have a new business venture. My partner is a great guy by the name of Brian Gilbert, who was president of production for the late Stan Winston's production company, Oscar-winning effect artist Stan Winston. Brian's in post-production on the new live-action Scooby-Doo. We're going to be doing the two sequels on the heels of that. We're also going to be doing a biopic on John DeLorean.
Wow.
And I'm reteaming with the writers of Haunting in Connecticut, along with producer Cotty Chubb, for an adaptation of a fantastic book called The Man Who Would Not Die.
Huh.
So those are sort of a few, but, you know, it's a long list of things. And there's also a very high-profile haunted house that I thought I was going to be able to bring up today, but I think it's going to have to wait until next time. But it's going to be an exciting one.
Oh, wow. That DeLorean biopic is very interesting to me. Is this based on a script that came upon your desk, or just a concept?
We do have a screenplay, and we've recently come to terms with John DeLorean's daughter, Catherine, and we've made a deal with her and sort of have the blessing of her mother, Christina Ferrari, and Tony Tomopoulos, her stepfather. They're not involved, but they sort of shepherded the process for Catherine. So we're really just kind of at the formative stages of that. We have a draft of a screenplay, and in the very near future, we're going to be going out, you know, to A-list filmmakers to sort of shape what we want to do with this story.
Wow. It sounds like a really exciting time for you. Does it feel kind of surreal that everything's coming together for you like this?
I think some days it does, and on other days it just feels like you know, this is how it was supposed to be, and you know, it's time to continue the hard work, you know, that has led to this juncture. So I just feel very fortunate. You know, I love making movies. I love working with creative people, and I've been really lucky to work with some not only really talented creative people, but great creative people. So
yeah.
I'm just going to keep telling stories and have fun with it as long as I can.
Well, thank you so much, and you're doing great work, and I appreciate you taking time to talk about The Haunting in Connecticut with us today, and come back anytime to talk about future projects.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks so much, Andy. I'll talk to you soon. Okay, that's Andrew Trapani, the producer of The Haunting in Connecticut, which opened big this past weekend. It's currently in theaters. And the other film that we discussed tonight with Ron Perlman and Simon Hunter is called Mutant Chronicles, that opens in theaters on April 24th and is currently available on video on demand. Not bad. We did 3 interviews in 50 minutes. I thank everyone out there for listening tonight. We will be back next Wednesday. And the whole Movie Geeks crew will be back with us. We'll have a Sarasota Film Festival recap and maybe a surprise little interview or two. And for you Movie Geeks United fans out there, you'll hear an in-depth conversation about the weekend spent between myself and fellow Movie Geek Aaron. And that should be a very colorful show. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you next Wednesday. Good night.